Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show, everybody. I'm Philip Drew, Administrator, your host. And our next guest is Ivan Elin. He's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute in Oakland. He's the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty and OnPower.org. He's the former evaluator in charge of national security and intelligence at the General Accounting Office, director of defense policy studies for the Congressional Budget Office, and investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He's the author of the book, Putting Defense Back in Defense Policy. Welcome to the show, sir, or welcome back to the show, I should say.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you back on.
Nice to be back on.
The first thing, I want to get to Haiti a little bit later on, if that's okay, but I want to talk first about the military tribunals that have just been activated at Guantanamo Bay. Now, it's the first time we've had military tribunals active since World War II, and the first two defendants are Ibrahim Ahmed Mahmoud Al-Qassi of Sudan, who is supposedly a money man, and Ali Hamza Ahmed Sulayman Abalul of Yemen, who is a propagandist for Al-Qaeda. And these guys are being now brought to trial in military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay is just beginning to take shape here. And since you're the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty, I figured that you'd be the perfect guest to help explain why it is or how it is that these guys are getting military tribunals and what's right or wrong with that and what ought to be done.
Well, the Bush administration is trying to have it both ways. They're trying to deny them status as prisoners of war, which would kick in the Geneva Convention, where they get certain rights as prisoners, and they should be tried in the civilian courts in the United States, which would offer them, of course, a civilian trial with 12 jurors that we're all familiar with. But of course, their status as enemy combatant, which is a totally fictitious status made up by the administration, denies both of those routes for them. So they're subjected to the military tribunals. And of course, the military tribunal, it's very different. Very different than a civilian court. First of all, you don't have an independent judge and a jury of citizens. You have the judge and the jury are the same. There are three military judges. Of course, they report up the chain eventually to the president, so that there's no independence. There are lesser standards of evidence in this trial. You can admit hearsay evidence, which of course you can't in a court of law. In a court of law, you need 12 jurors, a unanimous verdict, which means everyone has to be convinced this person is guilty. These panels of anywhere from 3 to 7military judges, they only have to vote by 2/3, I guess, will convict in this case. So you don't need a unanimous vote. Also, there's been one of the chief organizations of trial lawyers has the president of that organization has urged trial lawyers everywhere not to get involved in these because they're not up to snuff as far as the rights of the people go. Now, some of these people may be very bad people, but in our society, even the people accused of the most heinous crimes should get a fair trial because in many cases, as we've seen in Illinois, where a great number of people, I think 70 people on death row, were later exonerated. So even if they're accused of a heinous crime, they can get the wrong person or that sort of thing. And where this comes in here is that many of the prisoners at Guantanamo may have been rounded up by bounty hunters because the U.S. gave a reward in Afghanistan for anyone linked to Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And, of course, some people just needed money and went out and if they had guns, they went out and rounded people up and said, these people are Taliban. So there are a number of people at Guantanamo who are probably innocent. So it's very important that they get a fair trial so we can pick out the ones that are truly guilty from the ones that aren't.
Okay, well, you brought up a few things there. First of all, you talked about how some of them might be innocent. I think the government just let a couple of them go last week, right? After holding them for 2 years?
Right, and they released some other ones to their own countries for disposition, and some of those people will be let go, too, I would imagine. That's kind of an indirect way of saying, hey, we made a mistake. So, of course, the government will say that the main reason that we need these is for security reasons, which, of course, is absolute nonsense, because we tried the 1993 terrorist bombing of the World Center, the people who did that in civilian courts, and we tried some of the people involved in the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in civilian courts. So, and of course, we've had spy trials and mafia trials in civilian courts, and of course, we can close those courts off and have non-public testimony when needed. So it's possible to get a fair trial even if you do have classified information, that sort of thing. So the government's relying on that defense to deny these people a civilian trial, but in fact civilian trials have accommodated secret information, witnesses who are secret, that sort of thing.
Well, this is the real distinction, I think, is that Bush has said that they realized after September 11th that treating terrorism as a crime was a mistake, and that giving civilian trials to the first World Trade Center bombers and to the guys in the terrorist attacks in Kenya and Tanzania, that was a mistake, and that what we really should have done was started treating it as a war right then, and that's what he's decided now to do right. Instead of treating it as a heinous crime like they did before, they're now treating terrorist acts as acts of war.
Well, I think, he's fundamentally wrong about that. I mean, look at all the terrorists that have been brought to justice by international cooperation and also just good old-fashioned police work and even negotiation with other countries. I mean, the French got the infamous terrorist Carlos by negotiating. Of course, we had made progress with Libya on negotiating, and this was, of course, even before Bush took office. We made progress because Libya, Muammar Gaddafi turned over to Libyan intelligence agents, one of whom was convicted of blowing the Pan Am 103 out of the sky. And, of course, we convicted the example that the president's using. We convicted the perpetrators of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and so we took them out of commission. And the best way to deal with terrorism is to deal with it quietly, with intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies all over the world cooperating, and not fueling it by treating it as using the military and treating it as a war. And that war, whenever we go on a war footing, and especially a permanent war like the war on terrorism, of course, that has eroded our civil liberties at home. So not only are we being ineffective against the terrorists, but probably generating more terrorism. And we've seen a spate of terrorist incidents after this last war all over the world. Not only are we generating more terrorism by having a war on terrorism, we're also eroding our own civil liberties at home. And there are a couple of these cases where, and certainly the military tribunals are an example of eroding this. Now, these are non-citizens, but historically, when civil liberties have been denied to immigrants or non-citizens, citizens have been next. So we need to, we're not guaranteeing the rights of terrorists here. We're guaranteeing all our rights. And if the terrorist has a fair trial and they convict them, then I say so be it. Throw the book at them, give them the punishment that they deserve. But they need to have a fair trial, and we need to know that they're the right people.
Well, and it could be pointed out, too, that the Patriot Act II, the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003, which I guess pieces of it got passed, part of that, which I don't think this is the part that got passed yet, but part of that would give the president the power to declare anyone an agent of a foreign power and strip them of their citizenship. So that basically goes to what you just said, that as soon as they can do this to foreigners, they can do it to us too.
Right, exactly. And we have a couple of cases of where U.S. citizens, one apprehended over in Afghanistan and the other apprehended in Chicago, these are U.S. citizens who've been held without trial, incommunicado, and have been held indefinitely. And that's what happens in a police state like Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany. That doesn't happen in America, or at least it's not supposed to. And, of course, it has. And those may be the most alarming cases so far. Fortunately, the Supreme Court, I think, is going to look at those cases. But nonetheless, we don't know if they're going to rule favorably or unfavorably to impeding the administration from doing that.
Yeah, actually, when I heard that the Supreme Court was going to hear those cases, I was sort of happy and sort of nervous because they're the final say. So if they say that, well, we're not going to get in Bush's way because he's fighting a terrorism war here and we're going to go ahead and let him use his best judgment, then that's the end of that.
Well, of course, it's better if they do review it than if they don't, and we just have executive fiat. At least the courts, at least there's some checks and balances in our country left. Of course, you're right, it may go the wrong way, but at least the court, an independent court looked at it, or an independent set of courts, and it wasn't just left to the executive. I think, frankly, the courts leave too much to the executive in national security, and that's the real danger here is that the Supreme Court will do that. But these are such important cases that they may not in this case. We'll have to see.
You know, when I interviewed Bob Barr last week, he talked about the ability of the president to turn over Padilla and Handy to the Navy and call them enemy combatants, that came from supposedly the authorization that they gave him to wage war against those who attacked us on September 11th, and that they've basically taken this resolution that was one or two paragraphs long and read all kinds of powers into it. I mean,
you said
at the beginning of the interview that that the Bush administration just made up enemy combatant, that there was no such thing as that.
Right. And, of course, this is what happens anytime we have a terrorist attack, is that the government, the executive branch, is who we're talking about here, they try to get these provisions passed quickly. And, of course, they passed the Patriot Act a month after the September 11th attack. And many people in Congress hadn't even read it. They try to ram the legislation through it, and they try to make all these provisions general, not just to fight terrorists, but to use in other types of investigations. And, of course, they already have plenty of powers to do what they need to do anyway. And they're using the crisis to get more power. And, of course, that's been the norm throughout American history. Is any sort of crisis or war, the government gets bigger because of the crisis. People say, well, geez, we need to do something. They never ask themselves whether the last spate of legislation that was passed, and of course we just passed something before the Patriot Act in 1996 called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And of course, that was passed after the World Trade Center attack in 93 and the federal bombing in Oklahoma City. But of course, the provisions that were passed would not have prevented either of those strikes. And of course, subsequent to that act, 9/11 happened. So we give the government more power and money, and we don't look at the track record to see if they were competent. In this particular case, we passed the Patriot Act very quickly, as I mentioned. And of course, it later came out that the real problem here was the coordination of our intelligence agencies, FBI, CIA, and that sort of thing. And of course, all these Patriot Act provisions probably won't address that problem.
Well, but that's what the Department of Homeland Security is for.
Well, that's the problem, is that when these revelations came out that there were CIA and FBI, there was information in the system which could have helped locate these people before they perpetrated the 9/11 attack. The administration became very embarrassed, and so it has opposed creation of the Department of Homeland Security. Before then, it flip-flopped its position and now was a proponent of creating the department. And of course, the department has been created. The problem is that it makes the original problem worse. It creates yet another new intelligence office within that. And of course, we have, I believe, 14 intelligence agencies. And so all we need is another one, especially when we're fighting nimble, agile terrorist groups. The original problem was coordination between agencies. And of course, we've made the problem worse.
Of course. Now, maybe this is what I should have asked you at the start here, but if you had been president on September 11th, what would your reaction have been, or how would you have carried out America's response?
Well, of course, people were, you know, ready for blood, but what you need to do, I think, is there's some need for military action, but I think I would have limited it. I would have conducted the war against al-Qaeda, but I would have centered it mainly on law enforcement and intelligence. I would treat terrorism as a crime rather than a war. When we get this general war on terrorism, the president took this much too far. He's doing covert operations against Hezbollah and Hamas, terrorist groups who don't even focus their attacks on the United States. He's stirring the hornet's nest. Of course, he went into Iraq, which will probably lead to many more recruits for al-Qaeda. So I would have kept it to a narrow focus on al-Qaeda and oriented it more toward law enforcement and intelligence. You know, this administration has poo-pooed those, but they've had many successes in getting terrorists, and they don't stir up all the hostility because you deal with terrorism quietly. Of course, terrorists, their main weapon is publicity. That one attack killed 3,000 people, but most terrorist attacks don't kill anywhere near that amount. But, of course, the fear generated by these attacks is really what the terrorists want. And, in fact, the U.S. government has helped them do that with this color coding system because it makes people scared. They elevate the color level on vague warnings. Everyone gets nervous. And, of course, that's exactly what the terrorists do. It gives them a big bang for their buck. They can do one attack, a couple of attacks, maybe a couple empty threats, which, of course, we don't know if they're empty or not. And, of course, they generate a lot of fear because of this warning system that the government is under. So I think we need to take a much more low-key approach to terrorism, both here and domestically, get rid of that stupid warning system, which has become a parody on late-night talk shows. I think we also need to tone down our foreign policy so that these terrorists don't have motivation to attack us, which, of course, is why Bin Laden is attacking us, our foreign policy, and he's stated as much, our foreign policy in the Middle East. And then, of course, when we do get attacked, of course, the number of attacks would decrease, but when we do get attacked, I think we need to deal with terrorism in a quieter fashion.
Please explain how considering it a crime instead of an act of war is preferable, because I know the argument would be that, well, look, we're talking about suicide bombers here. These aren't people that you can convict them after they've done something wrong and punish them and they'll regret it the rest of their life. These are people who are willing to blow themselves up. So doesn't it have to be prevented rather than just punishing them after the fact, since you can't?
Well, it's certainly hard to deter these people, but what I just said before was that we need to tone down our foreign policy. We ought to really ask ourselves some hard questions. Why do these people that come from poor countries on the other side of the world want to invest their time and effort and travel clear across here and hide out in our country for 2 or 3 years before they do these things, give up their lives? They must be angry about something.
Well,
and no one ever really...
They hate us because we're rich and we're free.
Well, I don't think so. The polls in the Arab world don't really indicate that. They indicate that they like our culture, they like our political and economic freedoms. What the bulk of the population in the Muslim and Arab world don't like are U.S. foreign policies in that area, specifically propping up corrupt governments. And I speak to Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, et cetera, et cetera. And poll after poll shows this, but of course the foreign policy establishment wants to focus on our wealth and our culture because we can't do much about that. We can do something about our foreign policy. And if you look at all of Bin Laden's writings, he doesn't talk about our decadent culture. He doesn't talk about the sex, the promiscuity, anything like that. He doesn't talk about our wealth. He's wealthy himself. And there's certainly the Arabic and Islamic peoples are certainly not against private property. In the Quran, private property has a sanctity. We're not dealing with Marxists or communists here. And I think many people in the Arab world admire our wealth and our political freedoms. So poll after poll, as I mentioned, indicates that. So I think we need to ask ourselves some tough questions about why these people are attacking us. And certainly, we can take preventative military action if we run across an attack and the military can do something about it. But frankly, these people infiltrate our country, and it's more of a law enforcement problem. Now, of course, taking out their base in Afghanistan was a good thing, and I supported that, and I think it was a good idea. Where I think the president made his mistake was taking it to a wider war. We're going to do a wider war on terrorism. It's great propaganda. And then we now got these rogue states standing in for the terrorists that we can't find. So it's much easier to go after somebody with a home address. And certainly terrorism is a challenge. But I think the threat, as bad as it was on September 11th, that's sort of an anomaly. People say, well, we haven't had an attack since then. Well, that's a pretty unique attack. No terrorist attack in the world's history has come close to that many casualties. They got lucky, and also they had, a very brilliant plan. It's a sinister brilliance, but it was very well executed, and unfortunately it was well executed. So,
Those hijackers were, as you pointed out, you pointed out that the friendly countries, the governments in the region is one of the reasons that people hate us so much is because we prop up their dictators that they don't like. And I could point out that the hijackers, at least supposedly, were all from Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Yemen and countries that our government supports their government. They weren't from Iraq and Iran and the so-called rogue states.
Right, and the reason those people hate us is because they hate their own governments first, and then they regard the U.S. as propping them up. So, exactly. And, of course, we haven't seen any connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq as much as Saddam Hussein, as much as the administration would like to, dream one up.
All right, if you don't mind, I'd like to move on here and talk a little bit about Haiti. There's a big doings happening down there, and you wrote a great article for the Center on Peace and Liberty last week about it. I read something this morning that said that actually the rebels are sponsored by USAID, which is basically the CIA, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and that actually it's the United States that's pushing these militias to overthrow Aristide.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all because the Bush administration doesn't really like Aristide. He's sort of a socialist type of leader. Now, of course, he was democratically elected. The situation down there, I don't think either side is very desirable. The problem with these opposition people is they're supported by a lot of the dark forces from Haiti's past, meaning the dictatorships and that sort of thing. But, of course, the administration doesn't really like Aristide. So initially, they sort of made it known that they would want him to leave, and then they kind of backed off on that, and now they're hinting around heavily again that he's got to leave. But it wouldn't surprise me if the CIA has helped the opposition down there, but I don't know that for sure.
Well, and you write in your book that, or I'm sorry, in your article of last week, that all the pressure to get the United States to go there ought to be resisted, that we've intervened in Haiti plenty.
Well, yes. I mean, we even occupied the country once for, I think, 18 or 19 years, and of course, it never seems to get any better, and that's why, the Bush administration or the Bush candidacy in 2000 criticized the Clinton administration, and justifiably so, for all this nation building, because building nations, as we're finding out in Iraq, is extremely difficult. I mean, you have to change the culture, you have to change the institutions, And people really have to accept democracy on their own, and oftentimes they have to free up their markets before they do. For instance, in South Korea, Chile, and Taiwan, those are very success stories about where democracy eventually broke out. But of course, people, they privatized the economy, and sort of a culture of liberty developed, which went into the from the economic sphere to the political sphere. And I think this is happening to some extent in China. China, at the local level, has had some elections, and China, people have more rights than they do before. Of course, it's certainly still not good. It's still an authoritarian country, but I think that's the model to use, rather than going in with guns and, you know, freeing people. Many times, one side is just as bad as the other, and I think that Haiti is the classic case of this right now, because Aristide is certainly a thug, and so are the opposition people, at least the armed opposition people. So I think we should keep our hands off, and we've had a history of intervening in Haiti, but nothing ever seems to get better. So I think people eventually have to accept free markets and liberty by themselves, and sometimes that's a hard thing to sit by and watch, but Clinton intervened in 1994, and he put a humanitarian veneer on it, but really the reason that he intervened was to prevent the Haitian refugees from flowing into Florida. And so we find these humanitarian interventions are often justifications and cloak the real realpolitik, the real reasons underneath, such as the refugee flows. And I think, you know, they're going to be worried that this is going to start again.
Well, I mean, it's a legitimate concern. If war breaks out completely and Aristide will not step down, and the rebels, you know, try to take the capital city, we're looking at, you know, massacres and floods of refugees.
Well, I think it hasn't so far. I mean, the casualties have been pretty low for a revolution that swept the entire country. I think it's okay for us to pressure a settlement, but I think this fleet that we're sending down there, these marine ships, I think is the wrong way to go. Certainly we can help, but Haiti is a neighbor, and certainly we can help them try to negotiate a solution. I think we have been trying to do that, but I think we need to prevent I think we ought to avoid sending our ships. Now, we can debate whether we should have the refugees here. Frankly, I think that most of those people would probably get jobs and probably be fine here. Or they would probably stay here temporarily until their homeland got better, and then go back. Some of them probably would. But, I mean, if we don't want them to come to the shore, the alternative is to have the Coast Guard intercept them rather than to invade Haiti and, you know, police it. But I'm personally for taking in the refugees. But even if you don't want to do that, there are other alternatives besides the military invasion.
Do you think it's likely that if we just stay hands-off that whoever wins in the war there, or the struggle for power there, that, you know, at some point that the guy who's supposed to win will win and they can get on with doing their thing? Or is this going to constantly be, coup after coup after coup over there?
Well, I'm afraid it may be coup after coup after coup, but, you know, we've intervened in the past and we still had coup after coup after coup, so I'm not sure that we're helping the situation. I think, frankly, we should lead by example. The example is, hey, here's our society. Maybe you guys could eventually adopt free markets and liberalize your political system. And they may not be ready for that yet, but eventually they may look at the model. But I think, you know, we keep banging our head against the wall, and it doesn't get any better, even though we're intervening. It's just one more mess that we're... Every time you invade or intervene somewhere, by an outside power, it undermines the social fabric there even more. So I'm not sure an intervention by the United States had much effect. If we look at the 1994 invasion, you see that Haiti was the same corrupt economically restrictive place, politically restrictive place that it's always been. And Aristide was just a, you know, he was a different horse, but, you know, the same general type of leader.
It seems kind of funny to me how I've noticed some people who are generally non-interventionist seem to be a little bit more willing to intervene if it's an island in the Caribbean somewhere, because that's just too close to home, and it would be too embarrassing for the world to watch us ignore a terrible crisis going on right there off of our shore.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I mean, even before we became an intervention of power, intervening all over the world, we, beginning in the last century, around 1898 and on, through the interwar period, we intervened quite a bit in the Caribbean, but much of that intervention was unnecessary for our security. And I think we really have to ask ourselves, you know, maybe we don't have to always live up to people's expectations in the world. They say, well, you should be embarrassed by that. Well, why? I mean, this is a sovereign country, and we don't necessarily have to intervene for our own security. There's nothing down there that would adversely affect our national security. So I think we have to alter our mindset on a lot of these things. A lot of times we get puffed up, we fall into other people's, other countries egging us on. But I think France is egging us on in this particular crisis because it's formerly their colony. And they don't really want to intervene unless there's an international force. So I think they're trying to get the United States to do it for them. And so when we it's the same way when a person is excessively proud, you can egg them on to do stuff like jump off a cliff or something. And I think that's the way with the superpower now, that we're so proud and that we're the world's leader and we can't even police our own backyard is what the people who want to egg us on will say. But I think we have to say, listen, we're the great power on earth, and we'll decide when and where we would like to intervene, and we're not going to be pushed into doing something that we really don't want to do.
Thank you very much for coming back on the show, Mr. Elin. Do you have any closing comments?
No, I just think that it's best to leave Haiti alone, and we can certainly help them politically to try to solve the problem between the two sides, but I don't see military intervention as having much of a positive effect.
Great. Everybody, Ivan Elin is the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty and onpower.org. Over there at the Independent Institute, you can read his columns at independent.org, or he also writes for antiwar.com. Thank you very much for coming back on the show, sir.
Thank you.